Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. The Republicans have failed so badly on their promise to repeal Obamacare that the president suggested yesterday that he might call on Mitch McConnell to resign as Senate Majority Leader.
Well, I'll tell you what, if he doesn't get repeal and replace done, and if he doesn't get taxes done, meaning cuts and reform, and if he doesn't get a very easy one to get done, infrastructure, if he doesn't get them done, then you can ask me that question.
Now, that was a whole list of areas where Congress hasn't produced, but on health care, even more specifically.
Mitch, get to work and let's get it done. They should have had this last one done. They lost by one vote. For a thing like that to happen is a disgrace.
Also a disgrace, by the way, Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin suggesting this week that John McCain cast his deciding vote against the last repeal bill because his brain tumor was clouding his ability to think straight. Johnson decided that was a disgrace and has now apologized. But uncertainty about your health insurance is plaguing millions of Americans on and off Obamacare policies. Next week is supposed to be the deadline for many insurers to announce if they're in or out for 2018 and how much they'll charge. And a Washington Post article this week bears the headline, "The First Affordable Care Act Enrollment Season of the Trump Era is Still a Mystery." With me now, the co-author of that article, Washington Post correspondent Amy Goldstein. You may remember she was here recently for her book, Janesville, An American Story. Thanks for coming on again, Amy. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Brian.
And you write that the Trump government appears to be operating on contradictory tracks with respect to the Affordable Care Act now that it hasn't changed in Congress. What are those contradictory tracks?
Well, one thing that is known is that the fifth year's open enrollment season for people with Affordable Care Act health plans is going to start on November 1st, and it's going to run for 45 days. So that's the known. Beyond that are a whole lot of unknowns, and the contradictions is that the president himself is doing everything he can to try to tarnish the marketplace's appearance. He's been having photo op occasions with Americans who he calls Obamacare victims. The Department of Health and Human Services has been putting out weekly maps of those few counties around the country that at the moment look as if they may not have a health plan for next year. So at the highest levels, there's an effort to really make these marketplaces look as if they're really damaged. Lower down in the administration, deep within the Department of Health and Human Services, which runs these marketplaces, at least in the states that rely on healthcare.gov, the federal marketplace, there's more work as usual. In June, the staff that works with a group of people and nonprofits around the country called Navigators, who help Americans try to find their way to insurance, held their regular conference that they have every year with the Navigator groups around the country and told them that they should expect to get their grants next month the way they've gotten them the last 4 years. So there are these really different messages coming out of the different layers of government.
You mentioned that it would be a 45-day enrollment period for 2018 beginning November 1st. That's only about half as long as in the past 3 years. It'd only be until December 15th. And you wrote that it's unknown whether the Trump government will contact the roughly 10 million people with exchange policies to notify them of the shorter enrollment period. That article came out Sunday. Is that still unknown today?
As far as I know, it is still unknown today. And there's a lot of concern about how this shortened enrollment period is going to work. The last 3 years, it's been a three-month enrollment period that ran from November through the end of January. And whether consumers are going to know that they need to sign up for coverage if they want coverage starting January 1st and running through 2018, that they need to sign up by mid-December is an open question. And there are some insurers that are trying to get out the word. Some states are trying to get out the word. But it's unclear, as you say, whether the federal government is going to try to get out that word.
And you mentioned and you reported in the piece on the Trump administration abruptly canceling contracts with two companies that have helped thousands of Americans in 18 cities find health plans under the law, those Navigators who you mentioned. What's the status of that?
Well, these are contracts that are a little bit different than the Navigator grants. Oh. These were contracts to two companies that did similar kinds of work in, as you say, 18 cities around the country, largely in more rural and smaller cities, some in the Midwest, some in the South. And those companies, from what I understand, have been doing this work for 3 or 4 years now, and were suddenly told, without giving much explanation, that we don't need you anymore. They were told that by the Trump administration. There's no sign that those contracts are going to be revised, at least not at the moment.
Is it because the Trump administration actually wants to depress enrollment?
Well, nobody has said that explicitly. I mean, the stated rationale, to the extent there was any, that was given to these two companies was that they were always intended to be just for the early years of the Affordable Care Act marketplaces. Now, nobody previously had said that they were just for the early years, so what the real motivation was hasn't been said.
Also joining us for a few minutes is Jim Klein, president of the American Benefits Council, which represents employers who provide health benefits to their workers. A majority of Americans still get health insurance through the workplace, even though most of the media coverage and most of the recent controversy, of course, is on the exchanges and the expansion of Medicaid, which is non-workplace health insurance. Journalist Amy Goldstein from The Washington Post remains with us, too. Mr. Klein, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you very much. Glad to be with you.
Does what happens with Obamacare, which is for people not insured through work, affect people who are?
Absolutely. You know, there are nearly 10 times as many Americans who get their coverage through the employer workplace, about 177 million compared to roughly 18 million in the individual market. But employers and the people who get covered by employers really need to have a stable individual marketplace as well for, you know, a number of reasons. First of all, you know, there are often early retirees who are not yet eligible for Medicare or part-time employees who may not be covered by an employer plan. You know, they need a venue where there is viable and affordable coverage. Also, very importantly, and this is applicable to not just employers, but to employees and to people who do purchase coverage in the individual marketplace, to the extent that that individual marketplace is unstable and it results in more people being uninsured, those uninsured people are still going to be receiving health care services. And so in addition to it being a terrible situation for them not to have coverage, the rest of us who purchase coverage are going to have costs shifted to us. So all of these reasons really add up to employers and the people covered by employer plans really having a vested interest in the stability of that individual marketplace.
Am I right that some of the insurance policy standards set by Obamacare are in effect for all plans of any kind, including employer plans like the Essential Benefits Package, requiring coverage for drug treatment and pregnancy and the other things on the list, and also the ban on annual caps and lifetime caps for benefits for people who are really sick and need to draw on their insurance benefits? That all applies to worker plans, too?
Most of it does, certainly, like, you know, no annual lifetime limits and so forth. The essential health benefits feature is a little bit different. While employers may not be required to provide certain types of benefits, if they do choose to provide it, it has to be done under certain standards that are met. So the vast majority, but not all, of the let's call it the insurance reforms are applicable across the board. But there
so if Obamacare was repealed, it would affect people with employer plans too, because those packages would go away unless there was some other legislation that replaced them. Is that correct?
Not necessarily, because a lot of, you know, before the Affordable Care Act, roughly 98% of employers with more than 200 employees were providing coverage, and, you know, were providing, you know, good coverage. I mean, it's the most stable part of the whole system. So, you know, could there be some changes in some places? Yes. You know, do our members who are, you know, principally Fortune 500, large employer plan sponsors, you know, think that that would change the type of coverage that they would provide? No.
But the requirement under the law would go away for employers.
Well, that's an interesting question. Because of this budget reconciliation process that had been tried up to this point, only allows a change to be made in provisions that have a significant federal revenue impact. There are a lot of the efforts relating to this whole repeal and replace matter that would not change, would not be allowed to be able to change some of the insurance rules.
Right.
Now that they're moving forward on a bipartisan basis, some of that could change.
So what are your policy priorities right now, representing major employers who provide health benefits? There's so much uncertainty right now, which is what we're primarily talking about in this segment with journalist Amy Goldstein. What are your priorities at the moment?
Well, first of all, that stability of the individual insurance market, which I covered before, and specifically, most immediately, the continuation of the so-called cost-sharing reduction payments that help low-income individuals pay their other out-of-pocket costs, not the subsidies that help them pay the premiums. Those need to be continued, and there seems to be a fair degree of bipartisan interest on Capitol Hill for continuing those payments, even though, you know, we're not sure really what the Trump administration is going to do.
Why do employers care if the cost sharing payments for people on non-employer plans continues?
Great question, because it really relates back to the earlier conversation about needing to have a stable individual marketplace. If those cost-sharing reduction payments cease, insurers in the individual market can, under the law, could immediately stop providing coverage. Now, I don't know that they would all do that, but that certainly would cause them to shy away from offering coverage next year. And that will obviously lead to enormous instability and lead to more people not being able to afford coverage, and then all of the cost shifts to both employers and to other individual payers.
More expensive plans for people covered at work. Amy, let me invite Amy Goldstein from the Washington Post to ask you a question. I think you have one, Amy, right?
Yes. Jim, you pointed out accurately that the arcane budget rules under which the Senate was trying to come up with a Republican health care plan and failed to do so limited the range of things in the ACA that the legislation could have touched. That said, the bills that they were considering would have eliminated the enforcement of an employer mandate, the requirement that employers with 50 or more workers at least offer health benefits to their workers. Do you still want that to go away, even if it's off the table for now?
Yeah, we think so. Particularly, you know, if an individual mandate would remain, you know, there's even sort of less need for an employer mandate. But we've always maintained that, you know, you don't really have to provide that mandate to employers. You're correct. The proposals have essentially gotten rid of it by sort of zeroing out the penalty. You know, we'd be afraid, you know, quite honestly, of it reappearing in the future if it's not outright repealed. I mean, anytime you get legislation that is either, you know, enacted or repealed on a partisan basis, it's not sustainable. And who knows what the next political environment is going to be and what that would mean in terms of employer responsibility. So, you know, my member companies look at it from the perspective of they were providing superb coverage before the Affordable Care Act, and the reporting requirements that accompany the employer mandate have been extraordinarily challenging and expensive.
I'm sure employers don't want any government mandates, including on having to provide health insurance. But I want to ask in that context, why employers don't support single payer? I think your members' worst burden is uncertainty and the massive bureaucracy that employers have to take on as health benefits managers, in effect, when they'd rather just run their companies. So I don't mean it's the worst burden in all of business, but it's in the healthcare field. So why not be interested in the trade? You'll accept the additional tax that a universal system would require, but then you're free of all the mishigas of having to provide health benefits and not know what your bills are going to be. I imagine this would especially be good for small businesses who are really burdened by healthcare expenses.
Well, superb question. I guess I would take issue with one part of that premise, that they would know what the bill would be. I think that one of the big concerns for employers has been that it becomes a blank check, and every time then the costs go up, you know, that is simply directly passed on to employers. So they're paying the bill, but having no role whatsoever in terms of sponsoring the plan, managing the plan. There are other reasons besides, though. Employers still view providing employee benefits, health being obviously a clearly priority among them, along with retirement, as a terrific way to attract and retain employees. And with respect to health benefits in particular, they have been able to link the sponsorship of healthcare coverage with the kinds of wellness promotional activities that they have. Once the employer is no longer involved in that, sure, they can do certain types of wellness programs, but that linkage and the incentives to individuals to engage in those kinds of activities is really taken away because the employer is out of the equation. Sure. So overall, despite the frustrations, employers think that they are delivering something better and at lower cost than they probably will ultimately have to pay if we move to single payer.
Jim Klein, president of the American Benefits Council, which represents employers who provide health benefits to their workers. Thank you so much for giving us a few minutes.
Thank you very much.
And Amy Goldstein from The Washington Post is still with us. Amy, that was pretty interesting. It seems like the employers' lobby doesn't want Obamacare to get destabilized or those cost-sharing payments that conservatives hate to go away, because that'll put upward pressure on premiums for worker plans.
Well, what Jim was saying with respect to employers is really kind of a microcosm of the many ripple effects that people all over the healthcare system think would come about if the current law were substantially changed. For instance, states that have expanded Medicaid are also quite worried that if the Republicans in Congress and the Republican president were to undo the expansion of Medicaid, that that could put a lot of pressure onto the state budgets. They're also concerned that if fewer people were insured, which is one of the points that Jim was making, but states also fear this, that more uninsured people would translate into more people showing up at emergency rooms, say at public hospitals, and that would have bad ripple effects onto states' budgets. So even though there's a fairly small proportion of people in this country who are directly getting coverage through ACA health plans, Affordable Care Act health plans, the impact on other parts of the healthcare system could be profound if the law were changed.
And it's interesting that his conclusion on the single payer question was that it actually would cost companies more to pay whatever the tax would be to fund single payer than they're paying in these massive health insurance premiums in the marketplace that they have today. I guess that's a question for me to follow up with a single payer advocate on, unless you have anything to add on that.
Well, the debate over single payer, the idea of single payer insurance, is long and deep and has a lot of tentacles. So, you know, you are hearing, our listeners were hearing, you know, one strand in that debate. There are lots of different points of view about what would help people and help the economy overall if this were to ever come about.
And there may be a split between big employers and small employers on that, that the major employers who he mostly represents can absorb it more and more use it as a keeping private health benefits as a competitive tool to attract workers, as he was saying, maybe more than small companies. But again, that's for another day. What's the deadline that I've seen listed as next Wednesday, August 16th, something for insurance companies on the Obamacare exchanges?
Well, let me tell you what the deadline is and then tell you that that deadline might be changing. So for the insurance companies that offer health plans in the marketplaces in states that rely on healthcare.gov, the federal insurance marketplace, there are deadlines for filing of various kinds of information with the federal government. So the deadline that has been next week has been to file the final rates, the prices that insurers want to charge in those state marketplaces, the marketplaces in those states. And ordinarily, this has not been a big deal, but because the Trump administration has not said whether or not it's going to continue payments that came up a little earlier in our conversation, the cost-sharing reduction payments, which are a kind of subsidy that helps lower-income customers in the insurance exchanges afford their deductibles and other out-of-pocket expenses, because that decision has not been made, insurers are very worried if those payments were to stop, because the payments are made on behalf of customers, but they're made to the insurers. If those payments were to stop, pretty much all the insurers in the marketplace are saying their rates would need to go up a lot to compensate for that. So that's been a big deal this summer. It looks at the moment, although the Health and Human Services Department hasn't formally announced it, is that that deadline may be being postponed for a couple of weeks, but there's been no formal announcement to that yet this morning.
And
just some kind of word on the street going around.
And as you pointed out in your article on Sunday, Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price keeps bad-mouthing the law on television, but also keeps saying he will follow it because he's required to follow it. How much leeway does he have to follow the law in ways that are also designed to destroy it, if that's what he's planning to do?
Well, not all of the law could be undone, but there were a number of decisions that were made by the Obama administration by regulation, by executive action. So any of those could be rewritten, could be taken away. In the case of these cost-sharing reductions, it's even more complicated because there's a federal lawsuit that's on appeal. The lawsuit was actually filed a couple years ago by the House of Representatives Republicans because they've never liked these cost-sharing reduction payments. So the Obama administration had appealed to an appellate court, a lower court ruling that said that these cost-sharing reductions might not have a legal basis for being paid. If the Trump administration were to just say, okay, we're stopping the appeal, at the moment, unless Congress came back and appropriated money for those subsidies, there'd be no reason to make them.
And last thing, you have another article today on a bipartisan plan coming out of universities and think tanks for shoring up Obamacare, things that might be acceptable to both Democrats and Republicans short of repeal. I guess it would involve Republicans kind of acknowledging that that law is here to stay, at least for a while, and trying to repair it rather than replace it. This is at least the second outbreak of the B word, bipartisan. In the last couple of weeks, there's that bipartisan group in the House called the Problem Solvers Caucus, which is coming up with a solution that would shore up the law but wouldn't make Democratic purists and Republican purists happy, either one. Is the B word back in vogue?
Well, the B word is back in vogue with a segment of the people who care about this health care law. It's a little bit back in vogue in one Senate committee, the Senate Health Committee. Both the chairman, Lamar Alexander, and the top Democrat, Patty Murray, have scheduled a hearing for early September to look at what common ground might exist. Now, how far these efforts might go and how far they might go in a climate where, as you began this segment by pointing out, you've got the president bashing the Senate majority leader, neither of them very interested in bipartisan solutions. I mean, it's really an open question what's going to come of these bipartisan movements.
Amy Goldstein, Washington Post correspondent covering healthcare and the author of the new book, Janesville, An American Story. Amy, thanks so much.
Thank you.